So welcome to another episode of Romance Romp. I'm your host, Keeney Allen. Today I have Grace Burrows with me. She is a New York Times and a USA Today bestselling author. And I saw on your website, your tagline kind of is, I believe in love.
That is my tagline, and I do believe in love.
Fantastic. So do I. So thank you so much for joining me today.
It is my pleasure.
All right. Fantastic. So first, tell me a little bit about yourself, like how you got into reading romance.
Well, I started before you're supposed to. I was probably 12, 13 years old, always enjoyed language arts. But I'm also the sixth out of seven children, and I think I had to learn to be articulate early on, or I would have been lost in the shuffle.
Okay.
So I developed an aptitude for words and was reading well above my grade level. And one day, I think in seventh grade, one of my friends was reading this big, fat book. I said, "What are you reading, Emily?" And she had The Wolf and the Dove.
Okay.
Which is one of Kathleen Woody-Wiss's foundation titles.
Okay.
And what's that? I think it had a horse on the cover. I was quite horse mad. And, of course, a guy on the horse, et cetera. And she let me borrow it. And it was an interesting book. It was historical. It was romantic. It was substantial in the sense that, you know, it wasn't over in six chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it. And I just have been a voracious reader ever since.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As I've met more readers and authors, we all kind of have a very similar story. And it seems like seventh grade is like a very big year for people, that a lot of readers remember themselves like picking up romances around that time. I think that's teenage years when we were kind of looking for something more than, well, at least for me, like more than Babysitter's Club or Sweet Valley High, you know, where we were looking at something more adult themed, if you will, or I don't really know, but that seemed to be around the middle teenage years of when kind of a lot of people shifted over into romance.
I think of those as the crush years.
Okay.
You're susceptible to having crushes. You want to kind of try on interesting emotions of romance without getting in trouble.
Sure.
And without risking much of your ego, which is so sort of delicate at that age.
Mm-hmm.
And the vicarious experience that you have anytime you pick up fiction meets that need very nicely and very safely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, because you can kind of lose yourself in it and, you know, go on these adventures and still, you know, be at home on the couch or wherever. So,
yes, and supposedly studying for your biology test.
Right.
Not really.
Right, you can just shove a book inside of a book and enjoy it from there. So recently I saw on RWA, Romance Writers of America, on their, I think it was Twitter, they had like a hashtag, like, why do you read romance? So tell me why you read romance still.
I think it is the most complicated form of genre fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say it's the best form, but it's the form that appeals to me, because instead of just trying to figure out whodunit or watching a character who really doesn't change much from book to book to book have a thriller adventure, you are looking at not one protagonist, but at least two. Sometimes there's also a villain. They are undergoing character arcs. Both of those protagonists, hero and heroine, or two heroes, or two werewolves, whatever. They are not the same people at the end of the book that they were at the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to their sort of interior journey, there's also an exterior journey. Somebody is trying to save the ranch, or stop the king from being assassinated, or find her long-lost brother. Often the two protagonists have different external conflicts, or they're working on opposite ends of the same one, in which case they are both protagonists and antagonists.
Mm-hmm.
Add to this, there are going to be secondary characters and subplots. However, in addition, there's going to be a romantic arc. The relationship is really the main character, and that relationship is going to change and grow, and that too will be different at the end of the book than it was at the beginning of the book. And this is, when it's done right, this is a really complicated piece of genre fiction. to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I do read other genres, especially mystery, but that's more of a frolic and detour. It's not as engaging for me as a good romance.
Okay, excellent. I love how you've, like, you've claimed it. You're owning it, which I think, and I kind of want to touch on it a little bit later, but I think sometimes, you know, we don't really, like, you know, a lot of times you'll hear people say, well, it makes me happy and it makes me feel good. And those things are very true. But you're looking at it on a way deeper level, and I kind of love it. So
I'm looking at it as literature. And if it gets you through your family reunion without cussing out your uncle, if it gets you through, you know, your kid being off at summer camp for the first time, so much the better.
Right. I agree. So you've been reading for a couple of years. So at what point did you decide that you wanted to be a romance novelist? Like, how do you make that transition? Or what was it in you that was like, I want to write this?
I never made that transition. I ended up as a single mom before I finished law school. And then it was very much a matter of paying bills while I'm reading voraciously. Mm-hmm. And then it's raising a kid and paying bills. Somewhere along the way, I pick up the master's degree. And my advisor for the master's program said, what's your idea of an ideal thesis project?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I want to write a novel that compares and contrasts various aspects of the legal system as a conflict management system.
Okay.
I have no idea where that came from. I had not envisioned myself having any kind of fiction writing skills at the time. I wrote 400 pages of something, and it was a lot of fun. It wasn't much of a novel, but it was a lot of fun, and it did what it was supposed to do. It got me my master's degree and took a look at the subject that it was supposed to. So time marches on. Darling Child leaves the nest. And I'm still lawyering, and I'm sitting in my office one night filing a motion at the last possible moment because the client hadn't, you know, given me what I needed until the last possible day, and it's cold, and it's dark, and it's late, and I always had a romance novel with me. I still do. And I said to myself, I'll just read one chapter. Because I was getting to the point where I'm working more and more slowly and less efficiently, and I just needed a break. Yeah, right. And I pull out this novel, and this was one of the authors that I really enjoyed, but I just couldn't get into this book. It was the book where, I mean, authors don't necessarily have off books, but they can't hit the same A440 note with every book. And I wanted an A440, and this book was not it. And I said to myself, I bet you I could write one of these. And I was in my mid to late 40s at that point.
Okay.
And I wasn't writing with any intention. And I sat down and I wrote an opening scene. And that was easy. That was fun. I didn't at that point think, and I bet I could get this published. I never really thought that. I just had a great time. I wrote and wrote and wrote. It was like The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I would finish one book and two more would pop up. Sequels, spinoffs, prequels. It just kept going. I, though, have brothers and sisters, and they would say to me, when are you going to get that stuff published? As if publication contracts just sort of fall out of the sky.
Right.
And I figured, well, you know, the lawyering has paid some bills, but it's kind of a tough slog. I'm a child welfare attorney, and that means I deal in situations where children are abused and neglected, and I represent the kids. I love representing kids. You know, they always have a white hat. It's never their fault.
Right.
And I'm temperamentally predisposed toward representing people like that. But 20 years of it is kind of a lot. And you know, it dawned on me that, well, you're not raising kids yourself anymore. Maybe you could just write some books on the side. And so I went to a writer's conference and was completely overwhelmed. I didn't understand the dialect that was spoken. People were using acronyms that I didn't get, ARC and GMC and la-di-doo-di, which was advanced reader copy, goal, motivation, conflict. I didn't know any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured I've paid for this hotel room and I like to write, and I'm going to stop by the bar, get myself a grown-up drink, and I'm going up to my room and do what I enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I was going to hermit and introvert, you know, and, you know, leave the field without ever having engaged the enemy. And this conference started out with an editors and agents panel, which is where industry folks who know what's going on sit at the front of the room and answer questions. I didn't understand the questions. I didn't understand the answers. I was completely overwhelmed. And I wasn't prepared to be overwhelmed because I was an adult female with my career going well and competent in some regards. And to be a complete tyro, a beginner, somebody who doesn't even get the lingo,
mm-hmm.
was daunting. So I went to the bar for some courage, and I got myself a White Russian. And for those of you who don't know, that is Kahlua vodka and cream, and it tastes like a milkshake.
Right.
And if one is good, two is better.
Of course.
And I was contemplating the joys of perhaps even three when a lady was beside me in line to get a drink, and I noticed she had a knitting bag. And one of the people on this panel of doom had a knitting bag.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to her, am I supposed to pitch you? And, you know, pitching is when you sort of in 300 words or less explain your brilliant book to the people who might buy it,
right.
The people who might publish it, edit it, agent it. And she gave me a very patient smile, and she said, would you like to pitch your book? And at that point, every linguistic capability I had flew out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what my book was about. I didn't know my name. I didn't know what state I was sitting in. And she pulled a pitch out of me. You know, who is your hero? What's his defining trauma? And that person happened to be Deb Worksman. And she, where the conversation became more than perfunctory for her, though she was polite at all times, was she asked, how many completed manuscripts do you have? And my response was, 20?
Okay.
I didn't
so just
know
like
for
a
sure.
couple.
Well, I didn't know. Uh-huh. I didn't count them. I just wrote them.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, send me your best three. And okay. And a few months later, she called and said, send me three more. I sent her three more. And then she said, send me three more. I sent her three more. And she did an awful lot of reading before she chose where to start in this sort of spider plant full of books.
Mm-hmm.
And her publisher wasn't too impressed. Her publisher said, why should I get behind another debut Regency author?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a valid question at the time, because historicals weren't flooding the market, but they were being edged out by contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular house had plenty of solid historical writers. And so my publisher came back to me and said, do you have any other ammunition? Can you add anything to the pot when I go to negotiate? And I had won some contests and awards, you know, as these manuscripts were sort of grinding through the acquisition process. And I said, well, I final in every contest I enter. But there's a footnote to that. I did not know, again, because I sort of have hatched my dreams in isolation, that you're not supposed to enter seven manuscripts in every contest. And the interesting thing is, a manuscript that would final in one contest would bomb in three others.
Mm-hmm.
A manuscript that would win a contest would get scathing rejections from other judges. So it was very subjective. And I had volume on my side.
Mm-hmm.
But the editor, Deb, was able to go back to her publisher and say, look, you know, this person does well in contests. She wins awards. She has a real war chest. We can find something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with that publisher for a good 40 books.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was a very propitious way to start a career, because this Sourcebooks is a Sourcebooks, Inc. is the largest woman-owned publishing house in the United States.
Okay.
Dominique Rocca is the publisher, and she believes very much in the voice of women and supporting women as authors. And they did things for me that larger houses would not have done, like published a lot of books quickly.
So do they also use the name Sourcebooks, Casablancas?
That is their romance line.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So I've been reading romance maybe like 8 years, which doesn't seem like a long time. So I'm still learning a lot of these things. I do reviews on the side for a site. And so I'm still learning, like, one publisher has like different, you know, like Harlequin has like eight. That's not even true. They have so many different lines within Harlequin.
Yeah.
And other, like, Carina Press is part of Harlequin. And so, like, Sourcebooks, Casablancas, I only recognize that because I've gotten a couple books from them that I really liked.
It's a big industry. Mm-hmm. And you're experiencing as a reviewer some of what I experienced as an author. I don't know where anything is. I don't know who these people are, because the other authors were talking about so-and-so is acquiring mm-hmm. 80,000 words, and I think I don't know how many words mm-hmm. I've written. There's an art to it, and it's a big, small town.
Yeah, it would seem like it. And there is, coming in, like, doing reviews, so I've learned a lot of, like, some of the lingo, like a small portion of it. But, you know, sometimes, like, you know, it took me a long time to be like, ARC. Like you said, like an advanced reader copy, but now, I mean, I know what it is. And, you know, a long time ago, people would be like, oh, if you get a book from NetGalley, and I'm like, what's NetGalley? What is this magical place where all these people are getting books? You know, and so it is a small town, a lot of lingo, just like any industry, though, really. So it's not that different, but it's just our own little thing. So you've been actively writing for how long and published?
I have been published since the very end of 2010, so say 2011.
Okay.
And I probably wrote for 3 or 4 years before I was published.
Okay. And so on your website, I saw that you write historical, contemporary, Scotland, and holiday. Those are kind of your main...
My subgenres,
Your main subgenres. Okay. So interestingly enough, as I've been doing this, like... Some authors will say that they use, like, a different pen name when they do something slightly different. But it seems like you keep everything under the same name.
There are a lot of good names for reasons for varying your mm-hmm. pen name. For example, you may not want your YA readers stumbling into your steamier romances.
Right.
Or you might want to be shelved mm-hmm. near... I think Mary Balog is a genius. Joanna Bourne is a genius. I wanted a last name that began with B.
Mm-hmm.
somebody else might want a last name that's closer to Ward, H.M. Mm-hmm. Ward, J.R. Ward. And you want privacy sometimes.
Sure.
So a pen name makes good sense.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, because I am a practicing attorney, I wanted privacy. And also, my family never asked to be related to a romance author.
Mm-hmm.
So for the sake of their privacy, I use a pen name. And I'm glad I did. I think I write with the same voice, whether, and it's all adult romance.
Mm-hmm.
It's just subgenres within
okay.
romance. But I could see, you know, if I began writing thrillers or mysteries, that maybe another pen name mm-hmm. might be appropriate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, and I totally respect, you know, everybody does it differently. They all see it differently. And I'm always just curious about how it came to that. So do you have a favorite within those subgenres, or you just like them all? That's why you write them all.
They each have their charms.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when you're writing contemporary, you don't have to worry, was the word in English usage 200 years ago? What did it mean 200 mm-hmm. years ago? For example, the word fizzle. They used the word fizzle, but it meant to flatulate.
Mm, okay.
and are there readers out there who know that? The word cufflink. People have been wearing cufflinks since the Elizabethan era, but they didn't call them cufflinks in the Regency. They called them sleeve buttons. Well, we think sleeve buttons are something else. Cufflink
mm-hmm.
dates from the 1890s. How do you refer to an allergy when the word allergy also dates from the 1890s?
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of challenges are inherent in any historical work mm-hmm. of fiction. But with contemporaries, for example, many of my protagonists are lawyers because that's what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing these stories concerned that somewhere out there is a reader who is a lawyer and she's thinking, You didn't mention the 18-day rule. How come she filed a motion and she didn't file a motion to shorten time? Mm-hmm. Because there's no way she'll get a response by next week. And you said she got, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's, they're challenges. And mm-hmm. everybody thinks they're an expert on the contemporary world. Contemporary authors have a big hill to climb in terms of credibility. So, you know, they're, one is accessible, one has a little more of a vocabulary constraint. I love Scotland, mm-hmm. And I wish the Scottish contemporary was a big thing, because I'd love to write a bunch of them. So I try to balance what I've, you know, what my core readership is Regency romance, mm-hmm. and I try to keep them happy, but also occasionally, for the sake of my own freshness and where my imagination wants to go, I'll do the occasional contemporary Scottish, contemporary American, blend mm-hmm. of the two. Mm-hmm. In the Victorian period, it's just fascinating. You can go down that rabbit hole and end up in some amazing locations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't read like very many historicals at all, but I'm really trying to challenge myself to read mostly contemporary and kind of read outside of that box. You know, for many different reasons, you know, and I think part of it is as a reader, I kind of joke about it a lot. Like, the reader struggle is very real. There's so many books. We're inundated. And they're all, I like to think that they're all fantastic books. So it can be difficult sometimes to, you know, pick what it is that I want to read. But so Ingrid Hahn, who's in MRW, she, earlier this week, I saw her post, it was like a retweet of somebody else talking about language specifically in relationship to historical romances. And it was fascinating. And it was something that I've never thought about. Like, I would never think that, because part of it is like, as a reader, I'm kind of naive and I'm like, somebody writes it, it's magic, it shows up on my book, I read it, right? You know, I haven't, until recently, I haven't really thought about all the work that really goes into it. So, like what you talked about, like in 1890, so there were, obviously people knew about allergies, but were they calling them allergies? Or you know, just the language of the time and how to get that right. And so it was just really fascinating. And so I'm starting to have like a more appreciation of historical and look at it from a different view. And it's becoming more appealing to me to think about how much work really has to go into that. I really need to read these.
It's a challenge with a historical readership. The romance readership is very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. These folks know their genre and they know what they like, and mm-hmm. they're very vocal. But with historical romance, you are creating fiction in a real world. Mm-hmm. And the object of the game is not to describe Regency England down to the last chicken carcass, or, you know, whatever is hanging in the mm-hmm. kitchen. It's to create a story that keeps the most people in the book. Mm-hmm. When you throw somebody out of the story, whether it's with an accurate detail or an inaccurate detail, as a storyteller, you've stumbled. So you may gloss over some realities of that historical world for the sake of the story. Mm-hmm. However you make these judgment calls, they're going to be readers for whom you made the wrong call. Mm-hmm. And that's daunting.
You know? I'm sure. Yeah. You know, I mean, but I think from the reader perspective, I also know that, you know, not every book is for me. And I try to rec books. Like, I recommend some books to my sister. And so she was just telling me last night that didn't work for me. And I'm like, okay, that's okay. Like, I can find you something else.
There are other books.
You know, you don't have to feel bad about it. But I think that's probably really, that can be hard, like, as a reader. I mean, excuse me, as an author. To want to try to make sure that you're meeting all those needs of, you know, your, especially your established readers, the ones that are your fans,
your core readers.
Yeah, your core readers.
You'd think, having years of courtroom experience, I would have had thick skin. I've lost cases that broke my heart. Mm-hmm. My other sort of the as I started writing, I was managing horse shows. Hmm. And if there is a segment of the population that can be difficult, It's a certain kind of equestrian competitor.
Okay.
So I thought, most of them are lovely, but there is such a thing as a show mom. And I thought between horse shows and courtrooms, I had very thick skin. Nuh-uh. The first time somebody gave me a one-star review, I went into a three-day tailspin. And eventually, it gets better. You realize that not every book is for every reader, or I made one of those judgment calls that didn't work for that reader. But people take their romance reading very personally. And in some ways, that's good, because you get to know your readers, and they get to know you, and it's not always an arm's-length relationship. And they'll tell you when and where you got it wrong. And sometimes that's very good feedback, better feedback than you're getting from your editor. Other times it's just distracting, and it's difficult to know what to do with it. And you feel put on the spot, and you don't want to let anybody down. It just goes with the job.
Yeah, I can imagine that's very tough, you know, especially if anybody has like a, you know, kind of like that people-pleasing personality. I could never be an author. Like, I would be like, but this person said this and this person said that. And I just, it's not my thing. So I enjoy the reading so much more than I ever would writing.
She says this, though. She works for a newspaper.
Right. I work in the digital department. I do advertising. So, I sometimes, from a reader perspective, though, you know, I sometimes see readers, it seems like my, you know, my reader group, or, you know, just people across the board, sometimes they can be very demanding as to what it is that they want in books. You know, I've seen like reviews, they'll say like, I really didn't like this, I don't know why an author would do this, or, you know, we want something out of a sequel. And it's, I don't know, like, from the author perspective, like, does that feel like, well, I'm just going to write what I want to write, and hopefully it meets what they're looking for? Or do you ever try to, like, tailor it?
That's a good question, because, first of all, most editors will tell their authors, don't read your reviews, because you do begin to write in a manner that I call one-star proofing. You know, some dear old lady in Peoria said she didn't like that my hero talked to his horse. So no more talking to your horse, that's off limits. And another, you know, dear lady from Arizona says that she doesn't like it, that all they ever do is waltz. No more waltzing, the waltzing is off limits. And you begin to write yourself into a smaller and smaller corner, because you're afraid of the one-star reviews. The one-star reviews can be your best allies, because they will, over time, if a review system is working well, the reviews should bring into your books the people who will love them, and keep safe from your books the people who will not love them. And where, you know, that might feel like a somewhat uncomfortable process, eventually the reviewers are your best friends. They'll find the people who will love your book.
No, I agree. And when I'm looking at books and looking at reviews, I appreciate 1- and 2-star reviews, because if there's something in that book that I don't like that somebody else doesn't like, I want to know, because I don't want to read that book and feel unhappy or upset that I wasted my time. And
your money.
Right, and my money. Because one of the things about romance readers is a lot of us tend to be voracious readers. And if I'm reading 3-4 books a week on average, you know, the price on each of those books, like, I can't afford to spend the time and the money on a book where if I see a 1-star review and they're very honest. Or sometimes in a 1-star review, the flip side to that is they'll say, I don't like XYZ in this book. And I'm like, I love when that happens. Secret babies.
Yeah, that's my favorite trope. Yeah.
You know, or something like that. And I'm like, I'm here for this. I'm here for a secret baby. So, you know, the 1-star can work. I like it from a reader's perspective as well. But, you know, and if I see a book where everything is like all 5 stars, it makes me kind of question, like,
well, and authors are told that a range of reviews gives you more credibility. And, of course, you want mostly positive reviews.
Sure.
The reviews I appreciate the most are the ones that can say, the ideal reader for this book is so-and-so. I am not the ideal reader because of blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You know, say whether it worked for you or not, but also say, point the book in the direction of the readers who might like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I do reviews, if there's something that I really don't like, sometimes I'll say, like, this did not work for me because of XYZ in my personal life. Like, you know.
Right, or I've been reading too many of these lately.
Exactly, something like that, because sometimes it's still a really good book, but it just didn't work for me at right. that time. So there's a lot to be said for that. So I was looking on your website, and I saw that you just recently posted a blog about respect of romance novels. And I think that we talk about this a lot. And you mentioned you talk about it a lot. And I think it gets talked about a lot. And we just had that great piece recently on CBS Sunday Morning that I thought did like a good representation. So I think, you know, one of the things that I struggle with is I think everybody within the community, we get it. We get what we're doing, how it makes us feel, all of that stuff, the why mostly. But how do we get everybody else to respect us?
That's an interesting question. And I don't have the answer. My theory is that romance is regarded in... It is people look askance at romance because the bottom line with this genre is love.
Mm-hmm.
There are romance novels where there's nothing in it any more fiery than a chaste kiss.
Mm-hmm.
There are mysteries and thrillers and women's fiction that are steamier than most of the romance that I write.
Mm-hmm.
And yet romance is identified, of all genres, romance is identified with its erotic content. Even if it barely has any,
mm-hmm.
it's still identified with erotic content. And I think this is a way of saying we can deal with sex more confidently than we can deal with love.
Mm-hmm.
Love changes people.
Mm-hmm.
It saves lives. It, you know, creates martyrs where mere human beings are. It challenges us to be the best people we can be. And that's a very scary challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So when you confront people with romance and say, why don't you respect this? Part of it is there are a lot of people who just won't read it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what it is.
Right.
And, you know, the marketing doesn't exactly emphasize the philosophical values mm-hmm. That are behind the genre. But the other part of it is just it's very easy to dismiss something that intimidates you.
Mm-hmm.
And intimacy intimidates a lot of us. To be true, I think we're on earth to love and be loved, and that to learn how to love and be loved. And that means you have to let somebody really know you.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge risk.
Sure.
You can get your heart ripped out. Or you can be completely annihilated if you're betrayed in an intimate relationship. And these are our worst fears.
Mm-hmm.
So a genre that really picks apart our worst fears takes us, often at the beginning of the book, somebody has been coping with a terrible betrayal for years, often a betrayal early in life, or an abandonment. And that's hard to look at. Because mm-hmm. many of us are coping with that kind of loss and grief and pain and trauma. So it's not a genre for the faint of heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's not a genre for sissies.
It's not. And I think reading that blog post, it really made me look at it a little bit differently. Because a lot of times I'll say, you know, I think the reason why we don't get enough respect is because people are looking at the sex of it. You know, but, you know, when I take a step back and kind of think about what you said, that really kind of does resonate with me. A lot of it, you know, because nobody believes this that's outside of the genre, but it's not about the sex in romance. And there are plenty of romances that are fantastic romances that have little to no sex or closed door and everything in between, you know. So, so looking at it from the lack of respect because everybody, you know, afraid of love and that vulnerability is definitely that. And In fact, I got into a conversation recently with somebody, and he has a literature major, and I love him. He's my, like, brother-in-law. But he was saying that, you know, other works of literature that, you know, they can be deemed classic or quote-unquote worthy because they help with, like, self-enlightenment. And I said, well, first of all, that's very subjective, because what's self-enlightening to me may not be self-enlightening to the next person. And I feel like I've learned a lot from romance, and I'm not, like, living in the clouds, you know, like, behind these rose-colored glasses, but, you know, I've had to look internally at myself, at some of my own values, you know, kind of challenge different things. And, you know, it is also kind of, like, uplifting to think, like, oh, if these characters can deal with these, whatever their issues are, like, maybe I can too. But I think it definitely gets a bad rap for, you know, the wrong reasons, for no reason, really, but...
Well, it's also a threatening genre in the sense that if you derive your power from money, from good looks, from charm, from a tremendous academic accomplishment, romance says that's all very nice, but that's not the brass ring.
Right.
The brass ring is to have the courage to love and be loved.
Mm-hmm.
And if your power is invested in other places, that message is subversive.
Right.
Because you can be overpowered no matter how much money you have, no matter how good looking you are, no matter how smart you are. Love can change you.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us don't have the ego strength to deal with that, to hear that as a positive message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that I'll link to that post because I thought it was very enlightening. So I enjoyed that. So you had mentioned that some, like, the steaminess of your books. Would you say your heat level in your books is, like,
Moderate. I think I'm pretty brave for writing that stuff, but uh-huh. It's moderate.
It's moderate.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, but I think that's, for some people, moderate is, I don't know. I think we all have, like, a different level of what's moderate and stuff to us, so.
Well, usually when readers say something is moderate heat level, they mean it's not very explicit. You know, it's basic biology on the mm-hmm. page. And this is true in my books, and it's true in part because the content of an intimate scene isn't the biology that's happening. But just as every time you sit down to tea, somebody pours out, there's cream and sugar, there are biscuits. Every time you play a chess game, somebody has an opening move. There's predictable mm-hmm. action going on in those scenes. What is unpredictable and what has to hold the reader's attention is the emotional agenda.
Right.
And this is another way in which romance is more complicated than some other genres some of the time. Mm-hmm. I don't want to offend anybody by saying that, but as a romance author, you're probably going to write 3 or 4 of those intimate scenes per book.
Mm-hmm.
If you're writing 20 books, you have 60 to 80 of those same scenes where the same stuff is mostly mm-hmm. going on, absent kink. I would say the majority of romance readers are not drawn to exotic sexual practices.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to read some pretty mundane mating behavior
mm-hmm.
on those pages, and that'll be enough for them. But you have got to make it interesting by making every intimate scene different,
mm-hmm.
every intimate scene unique to those individuals, and it's got to be well written,
right?
Because people are not skimming those scenes.
No, no. I mean, you're right. It has to be a lot more than, you know, A into B or whatever, you know, whatever. I mean, you can get that anywhere. So it's a lot more than that. It's the leading up to it, all of it. So I get it. So that must be very difficult.
In every kind of genre fiction, there are signature scenes. In other words, finding a dead body, you're probably in a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Ticking bomb, you're probably in a thriller. And romance has many of them. There is a meet scene.
Mm-hmm.
There is a first touch, kiss, whatever you want to mm-hmm. call it. The, you know, we're sort of the relationship germinates above the soil line.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a scene often in the middle of the book where there's a commitment to intimacy. And there's a big black moment.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these scenes occur in pretty much every romance.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they all have to be written so that you can't predict them from one book to the next.
Right.
And that gets to be difficult when your readership is as sophisticated and voracious as romance mm-hmm. readers are.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. And doing this and meeting with authors and stuff, like, I'm learning some of the lingo about, like, how books are structured. So, like, today, actually, at lunch, I was reading, as I always do, and it hit the black moment, and then my lunchtime is over. And I'm like, what's, I have to go back to work now? You know, my reader struggle continues. So what, when we emailed, you had mentioned that you have several books coming out this year. So what's coming up for you soon?
Soon, March 14th. I'm in a little novella trio with Susanna Ives and Emily Greenwood, and it's called Duchesses in Disguise.
Okay.
And it's the novella anthologies are such fun because you're not writing in isolation. You're mm-hmm. writing with writing buddies.
Okay.
And we all start off on the same premise, that there are these three duchesses who are trying to sort of hide from the bachelors, and they're ruralizing and doing their best to just be regular ladies,
mm-hmm.
And they fall in love, and they have not disclosed their titled status. So three different authors go in three different directions with that. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. And you share the work. You share the promotion.
Mm-hmm.
In April, I have teamed up with M.L. Buckman, who writes contemporary romance. We're releasing two of our novels together in a duet called Big Sky Ever After, because they're both set in Montana.
Okay.
Later this year, and then I'll put the sequel to that one out in May, which is set right here in Maryland.
Ooh.
I actually set a whole trilogy here. The Sweetest Kisses was set in Maryland.
Okay.
And later in the year, the second of my Wyndham Brides is coming out this summer. That's too Scott to handle. It's just going to be a fun year.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, you said that about The Greatest Kisses, and I think I might have read those now that I'm like, wait a second, like, little bells are going off now. I'm going to have to check my records. So will you be at any, are you going to, like, any book signing events, any conferences, any, like, meet and greets coming up?
I often speak at libraries. I enjoy speaking at libraries. Mm-hmm. So there will be some of that, which is on my website.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also going to the Romance Writers of America conference in July.
Okay.
Which is in Orlando. That big signing and, you know, big get together. Mm-hmm. You see all your writing buddies.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be also some writing retreats or writing conferences where it's just about the writing.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned earlier, like, when you went to that first conference, that you were going to try to, like, introvert out. So are you an introvert?
Oh, man, I am a warp 9 introvert. I can go for 3 weeks without seeing another person, and I'm happy.
So how do you handle it when some of those conferences, like RWA, is, like, ginormous with all of those people?
RWA is about, it's usually about 2,500 romance writers,
uh-huh.
And they're all thrilled to be there. The first time I went to a conference, I prepared by reading an article, I think, by Jenny Ann Krantz, who's some things to expect at your first conference. Mm-hmm. And one of the things on the list is you'll go up to your room and cry at some point.
Okay.
And I thought, that's silly. I am 50 years old. I got thick skin like an alligator. I'm already under contract. I'm not going to do any of this going up to my room and crying bologna.
Mm-hmm.
Second day of the conference, who's up in her room bawling like a baby?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just input overload. Mm-hmm. I was overwhelmed. So now when I go to these conferences, a couple things help. I always take time for myself. I get outside of the building
mm-hmm.
and see the little sun up in the sky. I have good writing friends, mm-hmm. and I spend time with them at these conferences, which is really the best part of the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I just know that my productivity is going to take a hit. I'm going to need some time to recover from the conference. And you try not to do too many of them.
Mm-hmm. That would seem like it, yeah. I have met more introverts in this reading community than I have anywhere else. But
and nice people, very nice people.
Everybody I have met and everybody I have talked to has been fantastic, you know. So I enjoy it. A lot of times, you know, I'm not trying to not include men, but so far it feels like a lot of, like, women helping other women.
Well, I wasn't prepared for this. The author community is not based on scarcity or competition. It is based on the fact that there are 7.4 billion people on the planet. They all need great stories. There mm-hmm. are enough readers to go around. The other thing is it takes weeks to draft a manuscript, and a reader can go through it in a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I will never be able to meet the demand that my readers have for my books.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't I want my readers to be reading other people's books?
Right.
And I wasn't prepared for that sense of, we're all in this together. If I can help you find new readers, even though you're writing in my same genre, why wouldn't I?
Mm-hmm.
There's enough to go around.
Right.
And I think this is part of the reason why the romance industry is the size that it is,
mm-hmm.
and why it seems to be fairly recession-proof.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're spending $1 billion annually on romance books, and it doesn't seem to be taking a dent, you know. In fact, it seems to be growing, at least, I would think, but I don't know. I haven't looked at the numbers lately. So.
Well, I think when times are hard, people want comfort reading. Mm-hmm. And when times are good, they have the leisure to read.
Right.
So, you know, either we work both ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you always are reading a book and you always have one with you. So what are you reading now?
Right now, I am reading a wonderful story by Kelly Bowen. It's called Between the Devil and the Duke.
Okay.
And it's a regency, and the heroine is a card counter.
Interesting.
And the hero runs a casino, and he figures out that she's a card counter, and he hires her. But she is a lady of mystery with many problems, and he, too, is a gentleman of mystery,
mm-hmm.
and there's much chemistry, and it's just an interesting premise. It's very well written. Kelly Bowen. You just gotta love it. It's a wonderful book.
Fantastic. I'll put her on my ever-growing list of authors to check out and read. But that's really all I had for you today, Grace. So thank you so much for coming in and chatting with me.
Well, thank you for having me, and I wish you and everybody else happy reading.
Oh, thank you.